5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom.
On Lunar Mission 43, Blockade is asked by Josh about George Floyd and the protests and riots in his hometown of Minneapolis. We also talk crypto art, non-fungible tokens, and American currency collapse. A Pentagon war game where domestic rebels are paid in Bitcoin, and more Satoshi clues. We also talk about Bitcoin being the best investment of the past 1,200 years, donating crypto taxes to charity, and hyperinflation craziness. That's loco-ness for our Spanish speakers in Venezuela. Lastly, we talk Cardano and Charles Hoskinson. Crank the volume to 256 to maintain geosynchronous orbit over the dark side of the Huddle Moon.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantex. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Dark Side of the Huddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye of the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iThesound.com.
All right, and we're back with another episode of Dark Side of the Huddle Moon. I'm Blockade, the Huddle Model, and I'm here with Josh again today. Josh, last month, my hometown, Minneapolis, made the news for all the wrong reasons, and I watched my old neighborhood burn down. Josh, how are you doing?
Well, obviously better than you, Arcade, considering circumstances. I mean, South Korea, the peaceful, homogenous South Korea with very little immigration and very controlled immigration. So maybe that's a factor. Who knows? But let's not let that stir the pot at all, given the context of these riots, which are all about, obviously, something horrendous, to be honest. It was a crime against humanity. Would you like to expand on that a little bit more from the other side of the pond, or?
Yeah.
Well, I guess you're not on the other side of the pond. You're across the Pacific from me, actually.
Yeah, the other pond, the pond to the west of the U.S., I guess. I don't know if that's an expression. But yeah, well, I mean, I think people are making it a very racial thing, but also it's a police brutality thing. And, you know, people of all races have experienced police brutality in the U.S., and it's pretty interesting. I looked into, dug into some facts, and actually, killings by the police have gone up a lot in the last 10, 15 years while crime has gone down. Some people think it's related to the opioid epidemic or something else. But this should be the biggest story. But all around the world, they're protesting Black Lives Matter. But the biggest story should be, and I'm surprised how many people don't know this, is that George Floyd and this Derek Chauvin, who was kneeling on his neck, they were former coworkers that didn't get along. So I think the real angle should be two coworkers who hated each other, and one got revenge outside of work in a pretty fucked up way. But that seems to be like a small part of the byline in most articles, and a lot of articles don't even mention that. Shouldn't that be a big part of the story?
Well, context is always key for everything, and I think in this particular case, it doesn't really help the media's narratives. It doesn't really necessarily help ratings if you get straight into facts straight away. Let's be clear, though, like, neither of us supports any police brutality, just in case that wasn't obvious by the fact that we hate socialism and we don't like any centralized government. We want governments to be as local as possible and as accountable as possible. So just to clear that one up, in case there's any taken out of context stuff going forward. But given the way that this case has really reverberated around the world and the complete lack of context that has been given by all the media for all of this, as a podcast without any censorship, then I think we should be able to talk about it and talk about it at length, especially considering the fact that one of those ramifications has been your hometown, your home city burning down for no apparent reason. I mean, how does that help the cause of any racism? I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole nother issue. So yeah, obviously we both think that it was what happened in George Floyd was pretty messed up. And obviously, there's even issues with the coroner saying it wasn't asphyxiation. And I think it's pretty obvious that it probably was. Whether there's other cofactors, it doesn't really matter. But yeah, burning down businesses, you know, I lived in Uptown, which is like, saw some of it. And yeah, basically seeing pictures in the news of like my old neighborhood kind of being tossed up in flames. And how does, you know, there's viral articles of them looting Target, whatever. I don't think you should really loot anywhere, but at least Target, you know, the CEOs, the people who work at Target aren't going to lose their jobs. They're just going to restock and everything. But if you're a small business owner, you know, white, black, brown, Asian, whatever, and your business gets burned to the ground, you might not ever recover. That might have been your whole life savings in that business. So I can understand people's anger, but I don't know if that's the right way to go about it.
Yeah, I agree. It's not the right way to go about it. It has never been effective in the past. It will not be effective now. If your objectives are to end police brutality, then instigating more violence to then encourage more militarization of the police in response is not necessarily a good idea. Now, I completely agree with what you stated earlier, and well, it's a fact that the US police has become more militarized over the past 15, 20 years. Post 9/11, it's become a lot more militant in the way that it acts. If you look at some of the police vehicles and some of the uniforms and the outfits, and also the training for a police officer is only about 6 months to become an officer, but if you were to become a lawyer, it takes about 8 years. So that also doesn't make sense. So there are a lot of things in the United States about the policing that need to be rectified. I'm from the United Kingdom, where Robert Peel invented the idea of a friendly police force, a community policing, and that's worked relatively well overall. Now, some people might look at some of the videos in the UK of like the police basically being cack-handed about one individual with a knife and then 20 police officers around them not being able to act.
Yeah, but I've seen videos of the police running away from people, like gangs of them just running away from people.
But by and large, when it comes to this police brutality problem, it doesn't really exist in the UK. I mean, the only people that have been killed at the hands of the police last year were terrorists on the bridges of London. So, which is pretty good record. I mean, in the UK for 10 years, we've had 168 cases of deaths during custody. So that means when you've been arrested, have you died during the course of being arrested? And 168 deaths in 10 years is not great, but it's not very high either compared to the United States, which is super high. And then when you break it down by race, I mean, there's no question that the UK police is not a racist police force, because the majority of deaths in the United Kingdom are white criminals, and the majority of arrests are also white people too, but proportionally there are more deaths to arrests of white people than any other race. So it's almost like the police are being extra careful with non-whites. So I wouldn't necessarily say that the police are racist in the United Kingdom, and I would strongly encourage anyone to look at the statistics of prison population numbers and all that stuff, so you can have a clear conscience when you're making an opinion.
Yeah.
But when it comes to the US, I mean, It is, from my vantage point in Korea, where the police don't do anything about almost any crime at any point, that the US is pretty heavy-handed when it comes to almost anything. So there needs to be a balance, right? So what do you think, as a US citizen, the police need to do to change?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is that in all professions, there's going to be people that shouldn't be in that profession. There's bad doctors, there's bad lawyers, there's bad everyone, there's bad auto mechanics. You know, there was a famous doctor who was doing these crazy spinal surgeries on people with perfectly healthy spines and did it for 20 years and just like was driving a Ferrari around, just living it up. But there needs to be pretty strong vetting when it comes to cops, because honestly, you know, for me too, it's like I kind of have mixed feelings about the cops. And, you know, I've had positive interactions. I've had negative interactions myself. You know, one time I was, you know, driving to university, I had all my stuff packed in my car. He's interrogating me like I just robbed a house or something. And like, these are just my books and my clothes, man. Just leave me alone. And other times the cop has been nice. Hey, I'm going to leave you with a warning, whatever. But, I think it's maybe what I've seen is the way they're trained. It's like you're going to battle. And, you know, I've never been a police officer. I've never been in the military. But when I see these posts from the military that say like, hey, our rules of engagement in war were more strict than like what police have. You know what I mean? And not only with people, but like you see these videos, body cam videos where like, the cop just walks into the yard and just starts shooting people's shoot dogs, even like friendly dogs. The dog barks at them twice and he just unloads their Glock on them. And I'm like, there is an issue there, you know, like that doesn't happen in other countries where you just like, you know, the police officer walks into your yard, the dog barks at you and you shoot the dog and, you know, the police have qualified immunity. So I think in some places, I think the police aren't tough enough, and definitely here sometimes the police get away with far too much, and they have what's called qualified immunity, which means that you have to set a very high bar to like really prosecute anybody. But also too, we've mentioned this, you know, this became a big thing because of race. Derek Chauvin's white, George Floyd is black, and also talking about racism and also talking about how somehow this is Trump's fault. I mean, let's talk about Minneapolis. They got an all Democratic city council. They've got a Democratic mayor, Democratic governor, Democratic attorney general. They've got the Minneapolis police force is fairly diverse, but somehow it's Orange Man Bad's fault for what's happening here. So that doesn't really make sense to me.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. It's definitely being politicized for all the wrong reasons. And it doesn't end well either, because it doesn't really help race relations whatsoever. It's almost like the Democratic Party wants to thrive on basically pushing people against each other instead of thinking about what is going to unify the country. I mean, if you make race the issue all of the time in all of your policies, it's no surprise that some people are annoyed. I mean, I'm here in South Korea as an immigrant to this country. But I come from the United Kingdom, which is a very diverse place itself. But just seeing what's going on in the United States from the news, it just makes me think that the US has lost its way a little bit. I mean, they're really not really thinking rationally about any of this stuff. How is it right that you can just smash up someone else's store because you feel aggrieved, because someone of your race or a race that you feel sympathetic towards was killed by someone of a different race, and then suddenly it's a political issue that then justifies anything that you do, and then we have to posthumously look back at the crimes of X race in history, but not be accountable for anything that we do today? Like, all right, that doesn't make sense, guys. I mean, if we want to end racism, we have to basically treat people as individuals with agency. So we can't basically say, well, it's all right that he did that because he was upset because he's X and therefore he's justified in smashing up a store it doesn't make sense. There's no way that that's ever going to end well. It doesn't end well. It won't end well. And it's not like it's an actual race thing either. When you think about history, it's not even that long ago. If you look at the Irish versus the British, where you had the IRA literally bombing the Conservative Party conference in the 80s, it was like white killing white. It wasn't about race. It's about ideology. It's about what you believe. So you've got to get beyond this stupid paradigm that basically people are feeding you, that it's about the color of your skin. It could be anything arbitrary. It could be like, all right, Cade's a tall guy. He's 6'4" or something like that. Anyone over 6'4" is privileged. So we need to like have reparations against them, or anyone that is, you know, it doesn't make sense. When you go down that path of anything inherited, any inherited privilege that you have, therefore means that you owe other people so we can even the playing field. It ends up in absolute disaster. I mean, and here's where I want to go with this. Let's look at North and South Korea. So there is a story about North and South Korea. North Korea has just blown up a joint liaison office with the South today, about 30 minutes ago. The South just invested about, well, not just, but they invested about $10 million to build this liaison office so that they could have some type of place where they can have an open discourse and try and solve their political differences. The North just blew it up, right? So...
yeah,
well, it's Matt.
that whole thing about besides like privilege of race and sex and gender, you mentioned height privilege. Yeah, I've got height privilege. Check my Instagram. I've got a sexiness privilege. I've got strength privilege. I just go beast mode at the gym. And yeah, blowing up a liaison office isn't going to do well for North and South Korean relations, but I think it's all saber rattling. You know, like when I was living in Korea, maybe it was, I want to say 2013, like all the Americans were, you know, maybe our parents are getting weird stuff heard from the news. They're all telling us, hey, fly back, you know, there's going to be war in Korea. I think the North just does a lot of saber rattling, just to show that they're like not going to back down. And obviously it's just pandering. You know, we see Trump calling him the, you know, the little missile boy, and our missiles are bigger than yours. And, you know, it's really becoming like the WWE. It's like a soap opera. It's like a wrestling match. And, you know, he's probably just thinking, hey, I'm going to blow up this liaison office and really show them who's boss.
But it's the type of thinking that only comes from a collectivist government with no accountability to the people. You know, like those people that live in that local area probably enjoyed that building for recreational purposes at some point or another, because it's empty most of the year. And then they're going to basically blow it up because they feel slighted that they haven't got attention for a while. But this goes back to my original point of bringing this up, is that it's not necessarily about race, because Koreans are ostensibly the same race, right? I mean, from a European or American perspective, a lot of people think, oh, Asians are Asians. But after living in Asia for a long time, and you the same, you know, there's a massive difference between someone that was born in, you know, Sri Lanka and someone that was born in Shanghai in China. That there's a different worldview, there's a different perspective and different way of thinking about things. And it's accentuated by North and the South, where they are literally the same ethnicity, but with the absolute opposite worldview in terms of what success looks like. And what North Korea reminds me of is basically the Chaz region. Have you seen this Chaz stuff going on?
I was going to ask you, because I don't know if you've been following, but yeah, the Chaz Autonomous Zone, where basically they ran out of food in 2 days and they're asking for supplies from the outside. But yeah, it's pretty
just
wild.
It's childish toil. It's saber rattling at its worst, but it's only like, it's just the childish version with Domino's pizza delivery and soy boys who want, you know, they want to make sure that the meat that they consume hasn't been killed in an abattoir. They want it grown or something on some special farm.
No, Josh, you got to be woke. They don't want meat. They want meat substitutes and soy. They don't eat meat.
Exactly. So it's just insane. Like, it's just peak insanity. But I think there's a great contrast. But also, not only a contrast, but a similarity. It's like it's almost like the unicorn, right? Not the unicorn, the horseshoe. You know, when you've seen the political horseshoe, when you've got the far left and the far right, and they basically become the same thing. Well, you've got North Korea, which some people deem as far right, but actually it's far left. Let's be honest. It's a national socialist government. And then you've got these Chaz people, which again are far left. So maybe they're just, the far left have got something to answer for and they need to start having some good answers.
Yeah. And in that analogy, they're actually on both ends of the same horseshoe. They're both on that same side.
They're both on the left. They're both. Yeah. They're not even on the far right. I mean, the last far right dictator that I can think of that was even closely successful was like Pinochet or someone like that. I can't think of anything in recent living memory where you could say, oh, that bloke was far right. I mean, I'm sure that The Guardian or The Independent or another like really weak newspaper in the UK might say Nigel Farage, far right, or Paul Joseph Watson, far right, or something stupid like that. But I'm talking about legitimate far right dictators. I mean, it's been since the 80s we've had a good one. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, what you mentioned about North and South Korea, I mean, it really shows how important it is what political system you live under. You know, you could also talk about Hong Kong and China, or even in the U.S., you could talk about how much better Texas is business-wise right now versus California. California had that head start, but a lot of companies are fleeing there just because of taxes, because of unrest, because of maybe lack of security. But Josh, should we talk a little bit about art? Are you an art connoisseur?
Well, it depends, to be honest. I do like some art, but most of it is shite.
All right. Well, I think we should talk about this because we talked about earlier in the show an art piece titled I Can't Breathe sold for crypto at auction, and it sold for 7 Ethereum, which is about $1,700, give or take. And I don't want to talk particularly about this piece or what it represents. We already talked about that, but it's kind of interesting to talk about crypto art as being valuable. Like, you know, the last time we talked about it a lot was maybe crypto kitties, like crypto collectibles, and there's like Decentraland. And I don't know if this will really take off, but it's interesting to think of NFTs, non-fungible tokens or non-changeable tokens, as art and maybe possibly having value. So maybe because this is from a very famous worldwide case, and maybe it's got some historical value, maybe it'll actually go up in value. I think in general they won't, but I think it's interesting to think of crypto as art. You know, it's not my favorite use case, but I think it's interesting how in the crypto world they're trying different things. Some things are going to succeed, some are going to fail, but I thought it was kind of interesting.
Well, one of the good use cases for crypto is providence, right? So it's being able to basically verify where something came from. So a lot of people have said you could do the farm to fork route, which I don't agree with, because you've got to still believe in the sandwich problem, which is the guy who's inputting the data to the blockchain. However, once you've got only one copy of something and that original copy has been verified once, going forward, that can be verified anywhere else. I mean, in the UK, there's a show called Antiques Roadshow. I'm sure it's in the US as well. And every week, there are some people that come on and they get absolutely knocked off their feet by how expensive something that they've had in their garage for like 20 years is worth. But also, you've got some people that are convinced that this family heirloom that has been passed down from their great aunt to them is worth a lot of money, and then they found out it's just worth like 15 quid or something like that. So there is a use case for blockchain in the art world. So that this is a good demonstration of that. So yeah, I think that it's a great use case for cryptocurrency.
Yeah, I think you're right. I just don't know, like, digitally, if digital art is going to still have that same cachet as like an actual physical painting or physical sculpture. But yeah, I think it definitely could start a trend going in a different direction. Do you want to talk a little bit about maybe the US heading for a currency collapse? So I actually haven't followed this news site very much in the past, but I kind of like it. They're called FX Street, and they're talking about the U.S. possibly heading for a currency collapse. You know, people like Jeff Berwick, Peter Schiff, and others have predicted a currency collapse in the U.S. for a long time. The reason I don't predict it happening soon is because what are they going to replace the dollar with? You know, it's probably not going to be crypto. So if all the currencies collapse, we'll see even more of a peak financial clown world. But this article mentions kind of an 8-step process of how things are really going bad and kind of what you mentioned earlier in the show. You know, number one, instill fear, then lock people in their houses, drive tens of millions out of work, remove the pressure valves, whether that's going to bars, sports, concerts. Then you close the churches and places of worship, dehumanize through masking the healthy. You wait and strike the match. In this case, the match was the crazy video out of Minneapolis that we mentioned earlier. So this article is mentioning, yeah, get gold, get silver, you know, stock up on supplies. They're kind of predicting like not great things in the future, and you know, maybe getting weapons, securing your house and stuff. But they've been talking about a currency collapse for years, and obviously we're printing money like crazy. I don't know if you've been following it, but like just in the last few months, you went from a $22 trillion debt, I think, to a $26 trillion debt. Just like, you know, the trillions are just adding up every couple months. Oh, here's another trillion. And if you look at what the debt was, you know, just 20 years ago, it's pretty insane.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there, but yes, the money printer has gone burr. But regarding this site in particular, I wonder what it is that they are selling that where they're making their money. So maybe you have to upgrade, become premium to find out some strategy advice or something like that. However, it's not necessarily prescriptive. It's more descriptive. It's not really predictive. It's descriptive. They've basically gone back and described what has happened. Had they have made this article in February, for example, then I would be a lot more impressed. However, it's kind of easy to look back and say, here's what's happened and here's what they were trying to do. And then at the end, call to action, join us in whatever. So I'm a bit skeptical about articles like this in general, but I do appreciate the sentiment. I'm sure there's a large amount of people out there that are concerned about a lot of the things that are mentioned, as I am as well. But I'm also able to basically say, yeah, all right, what are you selling me, mate? Don't really want to buy it. Thanks very much. Off you go. Next story.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about something else. The U.S. Pentagon is known for creating war games. Sometimes they're pretty crazy. But the U.S. Pentagon created a war game to fight the establishment with Bitcoin. So basically, they do all these war games and these thought experiments. And basically, they're calling it the Z-Bellion. And basically, Generation Z is targeting corporations, financial institutions, and political organizations. And they're getting paid through cryptocurrency. So it's kind of it sounds like it's something you'd see in like a video game or something. But I think it's a little, I don't think it's great because it's kind of like demonizing crypto as like the bad thing. Like, oh, Generation Z is going to overthrow the government thanks to cryptocurrency. So I think it's maybe they're just like trying to be creative and like get into Hollywood. But I think it's a little, I don't think Generation Z is going to be protesting for, isn't going to be overthrowing the government through crypto. If anything, Generation Z is going to be begging for handouts. But that's just my take on it.
Well, it's interesting, the war game stuff. I'm sure that there are some data scientists out there that if they look at the declassified stuff, I don't know how much of this is open and how much of it is declassified and available to research. But that would be a fascinating thing for any data scientist to look into, is basically the sheer number of war games that are going on, and then how many of these war games become, you know, close to reality in terms of things that we could say, all right, well, that matches that parameter and that matches this other parameter. That would be a great assignment if you're listening, any aspiring data scientist out there, to look at some of the declassified documents of the Pentagon and think about has this actually happened? Because honestly, there have been a few in history that have looked pretty similar to war games, let's be honest. So it's hard to say which ones are just games and which ones are real.
Yeah, definitely. Josh, would you be interested in overthrowing the UK government if you got paid in cryptocurrency?
Not really, actually. I quite like the current UK government. If Jeremy Corbyn was elected last time, then yeah, that would be a great idea. But then again, the UK would be bankrupt by now if that would happen. So I'm quite a big fan of the current administration in the UK. I think that they're doing a good job despite forces against him. I think Boris Johnson's a good lad. So I'm not overthrowing for any amount of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I know that you like the current administration, so you wouldn't even do it from a selfish reason. As a crypto mercenary, would you have a price, or you just want to see what's best for the UK?
Well, to be honest, I mean, what would the money be worth eventually? Here's the thing: you need to get to a point where Bitcoin is actually accepted as a medium of exchange in most places, and if you take down one of the biggest governments that are relatively agnostic about cryptocurrency, honestly, I mean, the UK is probably top five place in the world for cryptocurrency trading and holders. And if you take down the UK, and so the UK just becomes like the sick man of the world, never mind the sick man of Europe, then what's the point? Because you can't use any of that Bitcoin for anything useful. Maybe you could trade in one Bitcoin for a house, I don't know, but then you'd be living in a socialist dystopia. So no, not at any cost.
Okay, I respect that. All right,
I'll fight you for it.
All right.
That's what they've been talking about this week, about taking down statues, like basically rewriting history because some people are upset about it and stuff like that. I mean
obviously
stop doing that type of stuff, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy. You know, they're tearing down statues all over the U.S. It's happening in the U.K. too, but, like, they're not going to stop anywhere. You know, like, are they going to, like, blow up Mount Rushmore? Like, you know, I read an article they wanted to take down Gandhi's statue too, because, you know, he said some, you know, things about race. But
here's the thing. This started, like, not too long ago. It started with third wave feminism. It started with intersectionality. It started with Marxism in colleges. It's a very slippery slope. This is something that has been predicted for a long time by many people that are conservative and saying, like, you know, where is this going to end? We're going to start, like, removing our own history and censoring stuff. This is straight out of 1984, like removing history so that no one has any reference to it and all that stuff. I mean, I've said this before and I'll say it again. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And you can't help but feel sorry for people that believe they're doing the right thing and that they are really trying to help the world and be good people and all that stuff, because they feel like completely justified in everything that they're doing, but they have no context, no understanding of history, and no understanding about what they're actually doing to the place that they live. They're basically destroying anything valuable and useful that they could ever hope to pass on to anybody else, which is history and perspective. And if you don't have any of that, then you've got no way of making a good future if you can't look back at the past.
Yeah, I think, these people that were predicting it, they were right. But at the time, people were just calling them crazy, basically. And you're right. Also, they're trying to tear it down, but they don't really have a really good idea of what they want to replace it with. So that's another issue. I want to talk about, we always talk about this in the show, not always, but usually we talk about who is Satoshi and more Satoshi research. I think the longer we wait, the less likely it is we're going to find out who Satoshi is. But Sergio Lerner, he did some pretty interesting research, and he found an early miner who used a slightly different mining algorithm, and he mined about 1.1 million coins. And most believe him to be Satoshi Moto. He decided not to dig deeper as to not disturb the creator. I don't know if I buy that. Maybe he can't figure out who it is. But he tends to think that Satoshi is altruistic. He's never going to use his coins. Me personally, I think now, like, he's never going to use his coins. It's going to be really hard to hide him. But, you know, I kind of think that maybe the creator of Bitcoin has already deceased, already passed away. But I thought it was kind of an interesting article that one of the earlier miners was using a different mining algorithm. And it looks like it was probably Satoshi, whether he's alive or dead or whatever. I thought it was kind of interesting.
It is interesting. Again, we will never find out. But again, the same type of story is about who's going to be, who was or who is or who will be Satoshi this week. And it's about the Escobars, and they think that they know who the real Satoshi is. And it turns out to be Dorian Nakamoto's brother, which is Yasutaka Nakamoto. And, well, just for some context, when Bitcoin first became, let's say, relatively popular in the mainstream media, they basically found this guy called Dorian Nakamoto and went to his house and was like, are you Satoshi Nakamoto? He's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're doing. Now, apparently, he's got a brother called Yasutaka, who also somehow worked for Pablo Escobar during the early 90s, I guess. And then there's this Swedish fella called Olof Gustafsson, who's now the CEO of Escobar Incorporated, who's in his early 20s. So this story doesn't quite fit together very well, doesn't seem to make any sense. However, if Mr. Gustafsson, the new CEO of Escobar Incorporated, is a businessman, as I think he is, he's just basically buying some media time and buying some press, because nothing about this story makes any sense from my perspective. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's unlikely. I'm not going to put it in the top 10. Obviously, the Escobars have been known for doing kind of things that get a lot of attention. They had a GoFundMe to impeach Trump that raised like $50 million. And they've done a bunch of other wild things.
Hold on a second. So they had a GoFundMe that raised $50 million?
Yeah, to accelerate the impeachment of Donald Trump. He said he had information crucial to Robert Mueller's investigation.
Okay, so, like, so that went straight in their pockets, right? And never was seen again.
I think the yeah. GoFundMe was removed. But, you know, they've been you know, they say stuff to get in the news all the time. Obviously, the things that make me think about it is that, you know, maybe they found his brother when it was actually, they found Dorian, who obviously wasn't it, but maybe it was actually was his brother. So maybe that thinks like maybe they were on the wrong trail. They just got the wrong brother. Also, too, it's he was definitely a criminal. I don't know if I think the creator of Bitcoin was a criminal or, you know, doing illegal stuff. But, you know, basically his old boss, Escobar, tried to kill him with a car bomb and he like kind of disappeared. So it's possible it could be him. But I don't know if this guy even has any sort of cryptography or programming background. So it's unlikely. I think it's another thing where they just kind of got the name. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's just a nice media spin. This Gustafsson Olav guy, CEO, he's in his early 20s, so fair play to him. I mean, he's managed to get headlines by using clickbaity titles and stuff on his PR stuff. I just very much doubt that anything to do with the Escobars and cryptocurrency. But if it was, well, hats off to you, or sombreros or whatever it is. Like, congratulations.
Yeah, yeah, well, anyways, the clickbait worked because I clicked on it and now we're talking about it. So,
yeah, more fool us. I mean,
yeah. Fair enough. Well, actually, I think I don't think this one is clickbait, though. I read an article that Bitcoin has been the best currency investment in the last 1,200 years. And it's basically talking about how if you would invested at, you know, the very early stages, which almost at the early stages, almost nobody knew what it was worth at the time. But in those 10 years,
Cade, what your craziest, like, this is the earliest price I knew about it story. And then this is what it went to story. Like, what's your craziest potential return on investment story that wasn't realized, but you actually knew about it. You had an inclination to pull the trigger. You didn't do it. And then you saw it go to the moon. What's the craziest one?
Are you talking about just anybody in general, or are you talking about me personally?
You personally, like, when was the time that you thought, that looks like a tasty price, but then you didn't decide to buy, you didn't pull the trigger?
When it rocket ship. Yeah, well, I remember specifically, I don't know if we've talked about it on the show before, but I first heard about it in 2012. I think I was reading about it a little bit on and off in 2012. I came about it from like the libertarian, like sound money perspective. And I specifically remember in the fall of 2012, kind of wanting to buy, maybe it was around like Halloween. And then I couldn't figure out how to buy at the time. And then it also, I think at that time, there was kind of a little bit of a bump. Like, oh, it went all the way to $30. I can't remember exactly what it was at the time, but it was like a lower price and it kind of bumped up. And I'm like, oh man, I missed it. And then I moved to Korea a short time later. And then in Korea, it was really hard to find it. And then I kind of forgot about it for a few years.
Do you think that it's going to be like that ever again? Do you think that those days are gone? Do you think there's going to be a... let's say in 2040, will people be looking back at this time and thinking, wow, you know, 10K Bitcoin, that was a bargain, that type of
thing? Yeah, I don't know. Obviously, I've got a diversified portfolio, as you know. I'm not like a BTC maximalist. I think like some of the other big blockers, I have issues with the fees and, you know, the unreliability of it. Maybe it'll be solved. Of course, I'm not going to abandon it either. But yeah, I think it's possible that it could 10x, it could hit 100k, it could go higher. I think for people that really want to get rich, or they want to have a bigger return, they should look at something that's still at a cheaper price point. Like, let's say a Cardano, for example, it's still trading at pennies. So I think it's more likely Cardano goes from 6 cents to 50 cents or a dollar than Bitcoin goes from 10K to 150K. You know what I mean? So I think you might have to look at something like that or another big project that's like under the radar. You know, you listen to a lot of people talk about crypto. They only talk about Bitcoin. Maybe they might talk about Ethereum. But if you look at something outside those top two or those top three, you might find maybe a rocket ship.
Good advice. Good advice. And then how do you convert that those mad gains into non-taxable assets, or into the next story, how do you pay taxes on crypto?
Yeah, well, that's the crypto tax thing is a complete nightmare, because there is no de minimis exemption. If you gift the crypto, if you gift like $10 of it, you got to somehow report that. If you buy coffee, you buy lunch, you have to report that. I'm doing my crypto taxes right now, and it's a nightmare. But one bright thing is you can actually, your crypto taxes can be donated to charity. And not only can you help a charity, but you can also possibly help yourself as well. So for example, there's a way that if you typically donate with crypto, you actually be able to donate and deduct 20% more than repurchase that same amount of crypto afterwards. So you're actually getting a little bit of a tax benefit while donating to charity. So I think that's pretty cool. But yeah, crypto tax in the US are hell. I got to, like, you know, email my representative and try and get a de minimis exemption and try and figure this out. Because, you know, we're going to get left behind if we can't use crypto to buy stuff. But I think the U.S. is going to be really resistant to that. What's it like for you to do crypto taxes, Josh?
Well, luckily, there are none to speak of.
Wow, that's crazy. You're just like Roger Ver. Don't have to worry about it.
Well, it's not even crazy, really. It's only the United States that basically taxes its citizens, no matter where they are around the world. And let's say, income that you've earned from outside of the Dominion is not taxable. So that's a good start. And also certain taxes are not applicable yet. And then there are some taxes which are traditionally taxed very heavily in the United States, which don't really apply in the UK either. So, for example, gambling. In the United States, it's one of the worst places to be a professional gambler because your winnings are taxed at like 40%. Even if you're a great player, you're really good at picking the lines, or you're a great poker player, whatever, you want to hand over 40% of your winnings to the government, then you've got to be an extra good player to get that edge. I mean, that's why a lot of poker players relocated to London from 2000 to until now, because there's no taxes on gambling winnings.
Yeah.
So taxes in the United States, taxes in the UK, taxes in Korea, taxes in Malta, taxes in different jurisdictions. Well, it depends where you reside. I mean, one of my favorite channels on YouTube is Nomad Capitalist. Have you ever heard of that guy?
No.
Well, check him out. It's a good channel. He's got a good book on Amazon as well. It's called Nomad Capitalist, by the way. But his whole thing is about go where you're treated best. And I've been following this guy for about 10 years. I mean, he has renounced his U.S. citizenship, just like Roger Ver a long time ago. He's got several second citizenships, and he's got several investment properties around the world. And his legal tax obligations are less than 1% per year. And he's done that legally, and he's followed the laws, and all he's done is just basically maximize his own position. So I like people who've done it like that. They've played it smart. They're not beholden to arbitrary wishes of people that they don't know. They just go where they are treated best, and I like that.
Yeah. When I said that was crazy, I was talking about, or that's crazy, I was actually referring to the U.S. and how crazy it is here with the taxes, to clarify.
It's mad. It's absolutely mad.
Yeah, and when Josh says mad, he means it's crazy, not that he's angry. Let's talk about our country we love to beat up on. Obviously, we feel bad for the people living there, but we got to talk. There's a couple things I want to talk about with Venezuela this month. And one of them is that this country that has, I think, maybe the biggest oil reserves in the world, if not the biggest, they're in the top two or three, is that now they're having chronic fuel shortages. That might have something to do with the fact that they've kicked out all the oil companies and they don't know how to produce their crude anymore. And also it was heavily subsidized, but now gasoline on the black market is fetching $11.34 per gallon, even with the high gas taxes in the EU and the UK. That's a pretty crazy price. And now they're actually running on like cooking gas cylinders, I think propane gas cylinders. So a country with some of the biggest oil reserves in the world has a huge oil shortage. And it's ingenious, and it's pretty creative that they're getting this way around it, using cooking fuel to drive. But it's also pretty dangerous. The gas can leak. You can breathe it in. There's an explosion risk. But it's just another kind of nail in the coffin for this, utopian socialist experiment, Josh.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty sad to see. Why don't people just look at history and learn from it? It's very obvious. I mean, we've got this beautiful thing called history, and we've got this beautiful thing called the internet, where you can basically look back objectively. You don't need someone to tell you. You don't need like CNN to tell you on the left. You don't need the BBC to tell you on the left if you're in the UK. You don't need Fox News on the right, or, well, there's nothing on the right, the equivalent in the UK. You don't need someone to tell you. You just need eyes and a brain and the internet and the ability to read. And then you learn from history and you think, all right, these things are not very good. Let's not repeat them. That would not be a good idea. It's awful, really, to see Venezuelans suffering under yet another failed socialist experiment. But I'm sure there will be apologists that will say it wasn't real socialism this time.
Yeah. Well, honestly, there's a lot. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of politicians back at the time with the guy previous to the current president, what was it, Chavez, when, you know, they were using all that money they gained through capitalism, giving it away for free. And it just took 10 or 15 years for everything to really, like, completely fall apart. And it's crazy. I thought it was going to grind to a halt a long time ago. I think, you know, millions of people have left the country, and, you know, pretty soon it's just going to be the political party there and just their cronies and the police and a bunch of poor people. Everyone else is going to leave, and we're going to see, like, the population go way down, and it's eventually going to collapse. You know, they're going to say, like, the U.S. overthrew the government. They're going to say this or that. Yeah, it just can't go on like this. You know, they have no food, they have no gasoline.
That's the greatest irony about the socialists. They often say, like, everyone loves it, everyone wants to do it, but you have to stay, and you're not allowed to leave.
Yeah, it's so crazy.
That's the ultimate test. Are you freely allowed to leave the country, and can you take your business and your goods and services elsewhere or not? And if you can't, then you're not in a free country, and all of the other things are bogus.
Yeah, and can you use what currency you want? I think in Venezuela, the dollar is what almost everyone's using. And this really isn't the nail in the coffin. This is just a little spice on top. But Wells Fargo actually banned Zelle payments for Venezuelans living abroad. And basically, this is kind of important because Zelle is a low-cost interbank transfer service. And you can enjoy free transactions between bank accounts using email. So if you're doing some other sort of remittance, you're going to pay a big fee. Obviously, you could use crypto instead. My thoughts are, I'm really not a big fan of economic sanctions. You know, with Venezuela, like, you know, economic sanctions or not, the country's going to collapse one way or another. You know, it's kind of nice if you're Venezuelan living abroad, and, you know, I know some, you know some as well, they probably want to send money back to their family if they haven't escaped the country already. But, you know, one thing is they could still use crypto and send money into the country and it wouldn't really affect them. But it's just another interesting thing. I think it has to do with the U.S.'s economic sanctions on the country, and maybe the banks are kind of playing ball with them a little bit. But it's kind of a story that's kind of going to go under the radar a little bit. But it's obviously another thing that's kind of tightening the screws on Venezuela.
Well, you've got Venezuela, you've got North Korea. You've got, ISIS are dead. They've been dead and buried for a long time. But when you think about what Trump inherited when he first came into the White House, he had to deal with North Korea, he had to deal with Venezuela, he had to deal with ISIS. And honestly, like, from a strategic perspective as an American, you've got to be pretty satisfied with the way that things are. I mean, Venezuela is weak in the region, North Korea is weak, and ISIS are gone. So, like, those three things are massive wins for Donald Trump.
And also, what about the way he's been handling China? What do you think about that?
Well, to be honest, I can't really think that Obama had any really good policy with China, apart from to pretend it didn't exist. But Donald Trump basically was like, wake up, guys, here we go, this is what's happening, China's eating our lunch. And then all of a sudden, like, a lot of people became aware of the fact that, oh yeah, all the manufacturing did move out there. I mean, you've got lots of liberals out there that feel really good that pollution has gone down in America, but it's not like their consumption has gone down at the same time. They just outsourced the pollution, and they, you know, they kept consuming at the same rate. So it was kind of one of those weird things where they're like, well, if it's not something that I can see, then it's fine. And at any cost, as long as I feel good about it. And that's basically what has happened for quite a long time in the United States, for about, well, since you could argue the late 70s, early 80s onwards, has been outsourcing manufacturing, importing the goods, and also feeling really good about how liberal and progressive that we were altogether, while consuming at all-time record highs. So just, again, outsourcing the pollution, making sure that pollution was somewhere else that we didn't see it, and then we feel really good about ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, there is some truth that I know, like, we'd ship our old computer parts here, and there'd be, like, these computer dumps, and people would be digging through the computer chips trying to get, like, the precious metals out of them. But also, too, it's like, our water treatment and the way we handle trash here is done pretty well. I think in a lot of countries, it's just an open air pit, or they're dumping it into the river, they're dumping it into the ocean. Maybe we do export some garbage or things we don't want, but we also handle the garbage we have here pretty well, you know, whether people want to admit that or not.
Well, yeah, they do. The US is doing well. It's not a world leader for nothing, Cade. It's a world leader because it leads.
Yeah, that's pretty problematic in current year, but let's talk about... you want to talk about Charles Hoskinson and Cardano? We mentioned that earlier. I thought it might be a good investment, not financial advice. Full disclosure, I am a Cardano bag holder to the dark side of the HODL moon. But this is kind of not really a fight or a grudge, but Charles Hoskinson, a co-founder of Ethereum, he was only there maybe 4, 5, 6 months, but they always mention him as the co-founder of Ethereum, and he really doesn't like it. He actually wants to be known as the CEO or founder of Cardano, IOHK. It's kind of like Elon Musk always being called the founder of PayPal. You know, he's kind of changed and gone on to do different things. So I think you should call him the co-founder of Cardano, but until it gets bigger, maybe the media is still going to call him that. But basically, there is kind of a little rivalry between him and Vitalik. And he mentions how Vitalik will mention other projects other than Ethereum, but it might be Tezos or EOS or even Bitcoin Cash. But he mentioned, I don't live in his mind, so I don't know why he doesn't mention our project, but he thinks it's actually hurtful to Ethereum because Cardano does a lot of research and they're kind of open source. They don't have any patents, so they could actually use some of Cardano's research and some of the things Cardano is doing in Ethereum's project. And after this article is written, Vitalik did do a tweet, and his tweet was, "I hereby acknowledge Cardano." Just that. So very kind of artistic Vitalik style. But it's kind of a little bit of a rivalry, but he's just kind of curious, why doesn't Vitalik, Cardano doesn't exist, you know?
Well, I don't know. This is kind of one of those discussions that we were talking about at the start of the show, which is grudges between former ex-employees. Who knows? I mean, well, they were both working on the same project at the same time, but what I'm trying to say is it goes back to the lead story of tonight, which is two people with a long history, and we don't know all the details. I'm sure that we'll find out in due course, or maybe we won't.
Like you throw it back. Yeah, former coworkers that don't get along very well anymore. But I don't think
never find out the beef that they had. I mean,
yeah.
One thing for me is that Hoskinson is definitely more of a business-minded person, and maybe Vitalik is more of a visionary.
I'm gonna throw it out there. I know this is crazy, but I'm gonna throw it out there and say Charles Hoskinson probably isn't going to kill Vitalik over their beef. So I think Vitalik is safe.
Well, let's be honest. That's probably true. I'd agree with that one as well. I think that the silent treatment is killing Hoskinson's inside, though. Like, he feels pretty sad that his Cardano project hasn't been recognized by the unicorn boy, Vitalik. So yeah. I think that's what he wants, a bit of attention. And once he gets the attention of Vitalik, then all of the devs and all of the fans of Ethereum will at least have a look at the code base of Cardano, and then perhaps they might be inspired to develop upon it. And then that might be the big dread that Vitalik has. He doesn't want people to be exposed to that beautiful, beautiful code base.
Yeah, the silent treatment can hurt sometimes. Josh, you know who I've been giving the silent treatment to recently?
I don't know, the cops in Minnesota, I don't know, Minneapolis?
No coiners. All right. Well, let's talk about crypto as political, because we've been talking about crypto and we've been talking about politics, so this is a good way to end it. The same guy we just talked about, Cardano founder Charles Hoskinson, calls crypto a political movement. And I agree. He says it's political as it gets, and we need to reinvent the concept of money and take it out of the government's hand and control it ourselves. And he says everything has to change. Trade changes, property rights change, business change, the business structure change, laws change. And I definitely agree the laws need to change when it comes to crypto. And the way we do things needs to change in general. We've seen big political revolutions before. And I think it's just going to be tough because the banks have a lot of power. They have a lot of lobbyists in Washington, D.C. But I think if we can keep the momentum going, hopefully we'll be able to decentralize a little bit when it comes to politics in the U.S. and hopefully around the world, and maybe let crypto be a little bit more accepted and let it maybe go a little bit more mainstream. I definitely think crypto is a political movement, just like sound money is a political movement, like gold and silver is a political movement.
Well, it would be nice if we could imagine that the whole world could adopt our philosophy. However, one of the best things that I ever learned when I was much younger was from a guy called Harry Brown and his book called How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. And it's basically about the idea of just giving up, trying to change everybody else's reality to fit yours, and instead just to adapt to the actual situation and the actual scenario that you're in, and do as little as possible in terms of interacting with the government, trying to get involved in stuff that are, you know, like meetings and action groups and pacts, and because your actual effort compared with your output in those regards when it comes to mass change is so massive, the amount of input you have to get, but so little in terms of the output, that honestly, it's not worth it. So I'd recommend you strongly read his book, Harry Brown, How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World. And he talks about just basically saying, do what maximizes your own freedom in your own world and minimize the outside distractions as much as possible. And if you can do that, honestly, I can say, with experience, that is much more beneficial and more enjoyable. So that's the closing thought for today, Cade. Let's wrap it up.
Yeah, I like that as a closing thought. You know, I'm a big fan of what you just said. I'm a big fan of crypto, and I think of John Lennon's song, Imagine. So I'm going to sing us out today. Imagine all the people using crypto in peace on the dark side of the HODL moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the HODL moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehodlmoon.com. HODL Moon!